Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes anti-Iran sanctions as crimes U.S. and Europe have committed against Iranians. Italy reports 853 COVID-19 deaths, highest daily tally since late March. And millions of Americans are ignoring warnings against traveling during Thanksgiving holidays as coronavirus infections keep surging across the country. Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Tehran has slammed the European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, namely the UK, France, and Germany, for taking a negative stance over the country's missile program. Now, the trio has long been accused by the Islamic Republic of failing to abide by their respective commitments under the accord. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also slammed the European countries for their complicity with the U.S. in putting the Iranian nation under the pressure of sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei described anti-Iran sanctions as a crime perpetrated by the U.S. and its European allies. Journalist and commentator Mustafa Khoshfish says that Iran needs to improve its economy to confront threats and sanctions imposed by the U.S.
Sanctions are the main weapons tools of the United States and its allies in confronting Iran. After years, they developed a kind of strategy that's called containment to push Tehran to talks to receive concessions from Tehran, and the experience that we had with under the nuclear deal. And posing credible military threat is the second wing. These two wings would help them push Tehran to the talks in order to receive concessions. So what the leader is saying is that Iran needs to work very hard on its economy to repeat the same experience that it had in its military power. This happened all as a result of three decades of hard work on Iran's military power. And now everyone acknowledges that Iran is a military power in this region. And what the Iranian leader is saying is that Iran needs to work on its economy in a similar way to repeat the same and similar experience.
Political activists have sat together in Tehran to discuss the latest crisis which have gripped Muslim communities, France's disrespectful comments on the sanctities of Muslims, and recent Arab-Israeli normalization have taken center stage at the conference, Yusuf Jalali reports.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of this gathering, attended by political activists. On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians who have been suffering under more than seven decades of Israel's occupation.
Those treacherous regimes have never cared about the interests of Muslims. They only seek to consolidate their foothold as rulers. I'm sure that the people of Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan do not share the stance of their regimes toward Israel. Muslims will never recognize Israel and its occupation of Palestine.
Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises and lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players, such as the U.S., never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, the death toll from twin blasts in central Afghanistan has risen to 17 as the country is grappling with the surge in violence in recent months. At least 50 people were also injured in the explosions, which occurred in front of a market in the city of Bamyan. No group has yet claimed responsibility, and the Taliban have denied any involvement. The attack comes as the Taliban and Afghan government negotiators are meeting for peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. Afghanistan continues to suffer from insecurity nearly 20 years after the U.S. and its allies invaded the country to try to topple the Taliban under the pretext of the fight against terrorism. A Turkish court has added six new defendants to the case against Saudi officials charged with the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Main court in Istanbul held a second hearing in the trial in absentia of 26 Saudi suspects. Court also heard testimony from one of Khashoggi's friends. He revealed a Saudi journalist was threatened by people close to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In September, Saudi court handed 20-year prison terms to five people while sentencing another three to 7 to 10 years in jail. A Saudi hit squad killed Khashoggi and then dismembered his body at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul back in October of 2018. Incident sparked international condemnations, with the CIA concluding that the Saudi crown prince himself directly ordered the killing of the journalist. A Saudi state oil company has confirmed an attack on its distribution station in the northern city of Jeddah. Aramco officials said the attack caused a fire at what he described a critical facility. He said that one of 13 tanks at the compound was damaged and is now out of service. Yemen's military earlier said it had struck the site with a Quds II type missile.
A successful hit deep inside Saudi Arabia. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters carried out a retaliatory missile strike on an oil facility in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Monday. The Yemeni army says a new winged missile called the Quds II was used in the operation against the distribution station operated by Saudi Aramco. Yemen's military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds II cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction?
Now, the Yemeni army says the Quds II missile with improved range and precision became operational just recently. Now, the ground launch projectile is the latest addition to Yemen's expanding arsenal of domestically manufactured weaponry. Yemenis say that they have the means to retaliate effectively if Saudi decide to escalate their military offensive. A Yemeni missile strike came soon after a meeting between the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. U.S. under President Donald Trump has been deeply involved in the brutal war against Yemen. And will America's stance change in any way anytime soon?
The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision-makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The coronavirus keeps rampaging through Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting new deaths and infections from the disease. Italy reported 853 deaths, its highest daily tally since late March. The health ministry also registered over 23,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. The UK also recorded its highest 608 single-day deaths since May. Official data also shows there were around 11,000 new cases, taking the total to over 1.5 million. Elsewhere in Europe, Russia registered a record daily high of 491 deaths and over 24,000 new infections. In Turkey, daily coronavirus death toll there hit a record high of 161. The country introduced nationwide restrictive measures last week amid a surge in cases. The European Union says it will sign a contract with American drug maker Moderna for the supply of a coronavirus vaccine candidate. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the contract will take the bloc's potential vaccine stock to nearly 2 billion shots. Announcement came a week after Moderna claimed its experimental vaccine showed almost 95% efficacy in preventing the disease. Brussels has already secured millions of doses of vaccines being developed by other American drug firms and their European partners. It's also in talks with another U.S. firm, Novavax, for a possible additional supply deal as well. Von der Leyen said all vaccines will be evaluated carefully by European Medicines Agency, the EMA, before final authorization. Projected U.S. presidential-elect Joe Biden has formally introduced his nominations for high-profile cabinet posts as the transition of power appears to be gaining momentum.
Today, I'm pleased to announce nominations and staff for critical foreign policy and national security positions in my administration. It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies.
In an event, the Delaware City of Wilmington, Biden confirmed that Anthony Blinken will be his Secretary of State. Biden also named Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security. He introduced Avril Haines to be Director of National Intelligence. She'll be the first woman to hold that post. Biden also presented John Kerry to be his Climate Secretary. The announcements come a day after President Donald Trump authorized his administration to officially begin the transition process. However, Trump has still refused to concede defeat and vowed to continue the fight in court. Millions of Americans are ignoring warnings against Thanksgiving travel amid a surge in coronavirus infections. Around 3 million people went through U.S. airport checkpoints from Friday through Sunday. That was the biggest such crowd since mid-March when COVID-19 broke out in America. Numbers are expected to rise, with as many as 50 million people expected to travel by various means this week to celebrate Thanksgiving holidays. A recent survey revealed a third of American parents believe risk of getting or spreading the virus is worth gathering for Thanksgiving this year. This as new cases of the virus and related deaths in the U.S. have hit all-time highs. Overall, the virus has claimed more than 250,000 lives in the country and infected nearly 12.5 million thus far. Police in Chile have clashed with anti-government protesters in the capital, Santiago. Police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the demonstrators. People were out in the streets to oppose efforts by Chilean President Sebastián Piñera to stop the advancement of an opposition-sponsored bill. Now, that bill aims to allow citizens to draw down a second installment from the privately held pensions. The government says that the measure, among other things, implies a cost to the public purse that can only be determined by the executive. The president said that he will appeal the constitutional court to halt it. Supporters say the bill helps those struggling with economic hardships caused by the coronavirus pandemic. And clashes have erupted in the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre during protests against the killing of a black man by two white cops. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse protesters who hit officers with stones and fireworks. The protesters also occupied a street outside a Carrefour branch in Porto Alegre. Chain store has faced a wave of boycott calls as well as violent protests outside its branches across Brazil. Now, that happened after the death of a black man, João Alberto Silveira, on Thursday. He was punched to death by security guards at a Carrefour store. His death has drawn comparisons with anti-racism protests that have rocked the U.S. in May. Since May, I should say. Hundreds of flights have been canceled at one of China's busiest airports after a small cluster of COVID-19 cases was linked to several cargo handlers. Officials say over 500 flights out of Shanghai's international airport were canceled Tuesday. They say thousands of staff have been tested, while high-risk workers will receive an experimental vaccine. Now, since July, China has been providing that type of vaccine to state employees, international students, and essential workers heading abroad. Coronavirus first emerged in the country in December last year. The country has largely brought the pandemic under control by enforcing very strict lockdowns and restrictions. But the battle is ongoing to contain domestic outbreaks in different cities. Now, China has accused the UK, that is, of having a colonial mindset after the British government said it is considering withdrawing its judges from Hong Kong's highest court. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson also called on London to stop interfering in other countries' internal matters. This after the British Foreign Secretary raised questions over a newly enacted national security law for Hong Kong and the purge of anti-China lawmakers there. Dominic Raab said that such measures erode the city's freedoms and are against promises that China made before taking control of the commercial hub. Row between Britain and China over Hong Kong has intensified since the city was gripped by anti-government protests, which repeatedly descended into violent standoffs with police. Beijing has time and again accused the U.S. and U.K. of fomenting the violence to destabilize mainland China. And that's it for your latest. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Radio. a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Since COVID-19 struck in March, the combined wealth of the 647 richest Americans has increased by nearly $1 trillion, largely at the expense of workers' safety and sometimes their lives, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading Billionaire Bonanza Continues as Workers Pounded by Pandemic, Recession, and GOP Relief Refusal. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A handful of billionaires and corporations are enjoying record financial gains, often attained at the expense of worker safety. During the peaking coronavirus pandemic, according to a report published recently by a coalition of advocacy groups, as over 1,000 people in the United States alone die each day during the deadliest pandemic in a century, plutocrats and their businesses are thriving like never before, in no small part due to a system rife with profiteering, opportunism, and worker exploitation. So says the report, entitled Billionaire Wealth Versus Community Health, Protecting Essential Workers from Pandemic Profiteers, which focuses on 12 of the most egregious pandemic profiteers. The delinquent dozen, who include the owners of Walmart and the CEOs of Amazon and Target. These companies and their owners and executives have benefited from their monopoly positions, the report states. But their success hasn't translated into better pay or safer working conditions for the employees showing up to work in a pandemic. It's not just corporations. Private equity firms have bought up essential businesses in the healthcare, grocery, and pet care industries only to aggressively cut costs, skimp on worker safety, and load companies up with debts to boost their own profits, the report notes. Among its key findings include, as of November 17th, the combined wealth of 647 U.S. billionaires increased by almost $960 billion since mid-March, the beginning of the pandemic lockdown. Since March, there are 33 new billionaires in the United States. Driving this exploding inequality are 12 companies whose profits are coming at the expense of workers and communities, including retailers like Walmart, Amazon, Target, and Dollar Tree, and dollar store gig economy companies like Instacart, and food producers like Tyson Foods. Also included is the investment giant BlackRock and private equity firms like Lennard Green Partners, Blackstone, Kohlberg, Kravis Roberts & Co., Cerberus Capital, BC Partners, and CVC Capital Partners. These private equity firms own several essential healthcare, grocery, and pet supply companies. 10 billionaire owners of delinquent dozen companies have a combined worth of $433 billion. Since March 18, their combined personal wealth has ballooned by $127.5 billion, a 42% increase. These 10 billionaires are Jeff Bezos from Amazon, Alice Robb and Jim Walton from Walmart, Apoorva Mehta from Instacart, John Tyson from Tyson Foods, Steve Schwartzman from Blackstone, Henry Kravis and George Roberts from KKR, and Steve Feinberg from Cerberus. The report features harrowing testimonies from workers affected both by the pandemic and their employers' policies and actions. I closed the register many nights, so I know my store's revenue has practically doubled since the coronavirus hit, said Kenny Slaughter, an employee of Dollar General, which is partly owned by the global financial behemoth BlackRock. But we workers haven't gotten any extra money, even though we are risking our health and our family's health to keep stores running. Curtin C. Brown, an Amazon Fresh warehouse worker in New Jersey and organizer with the worker advocacy group United for Respect, said, while Amazon's Jeff Bezos is on track to become the world's first trillionaire, the frontline workers like me who've built his fortune are treated like we are disposable. Brown, Amazon Fresh warehouse worker, added, as the virus spikes, we get more and more orders, and Amazon expects us to work at inhumane rates. The pace is blistering and people get injured on the job a lot. People get sick. People are scared of catching COVID-19, and Amazon is not doing enough to protect our lives. It's time for Amazon's workers to get some actual compensation for the essential work we're doing. We don't need feel-good TV commercials thanking us for being heroes. We need $5 an hour in hazard pay, paid sick leave, and workplace protections from this dangerous virus. The report contains a set of recommended solutions for companies employing essential workers, as well as for lawmakers seeking to protect workers and reduce the power of plutocrats and the businesses they own. For employers, these include immediately offering workers at least $5 per hour in hazard pay, paid sick leave, and other essential benefits. For legislators, an essential workers' bill of rights, workplace health councils, a pandemic wealth tax, and a profiteering oversight committee are among the recommended remedies. When billionaire owners and CEOs fail to fulfill their responsibility during this extraordinary time, it is the duty of elected officials and Congress to step in and enact public policies to protect essential workers and their communities. Chuck Collins, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and one of the authors of the report, wrote in a Common Dreams co-op-ed published recently. The contrast between billionaires making no sacrifice while their essential workers make the ultimate sacrifice, risking their health, their families, and their livelihoods, is both unethical and corrupt, Collins added. The report was produced by Bargaining for the Common Good, the Institute for Policy Studies, and United for Respect, and published in partnership with Action Center on Race and Economy, Americans for Financial Reform, Jobs with Justice, New York Communities for Change, Step Up Louisiana, and Working Washington.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Rai Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. We wanted to discuss what are some important factors to remember whilst training children to be raised Islamically and what we should be aware of, like the don'ts, what we shouldn't do, because we usually know what to do, so now maybe we should try and know what we shouldn't do.
The don'ts, right?
Yeah, the don'ts.
The do's we know, like to love them is the do. Do love them, do justice, do enact justice, do not break your, for example, trust, or do not break your promise, or you know, do love them and do take care of them. But now the don'ts, some of the don'ts I want to outline, you know, like briefly, in religious training especially, is don't do it harshly.
Okay.
Getting angry with the child and forcing him especially leads to this kind of hate and resentment in the child. He won't feel like doing that thing.
Definitely.
So it is better to explain the child, discuss with the child, of course. And of course, role modeling is the actual thing that affects the child in the long run. But if, for example, you have to explain it, don't do it with resentment. Mm. Or don't do it harshly. So explain and discuss in low tones. Don't.
Great.
And then another don't.
Okay.
Is don't overdo it.
Okay.
You know, like for example, the prayer is so important. Now don't keep on overdoing it, keeping on and on explaining him, or keeping on and on telling him how this is also important and this mustahab is also important. Teach religion in moderate doses.
Yeah.
You see, overdoing it can be harmful and can be also a burden to a child.
Yeah, I think right now the kids, the way they say, unfortunately we hear it a lot, they say please don't preach.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the time.
I don't want to hear a lecture now.
Yeah.
Because of the overdoing it,
Unfortunately.
So a wise parent would always be very smart and when advising the child, you know. So children should not be made to recite a lot of du'as and, you know, mustahab prayers, if he's unwilling, of course.
Yeah.
Because if he's willing, that would be, for example, light upon light, I feel. That's the best way. So never force the child even to pray. If the child is very small, don't even force the child, even if they've gone to the mosque. Like, you know, I take my daughter to the mosque sometimes and I see her not praying.
Yeah.
And, or she prays without a scarf. But she's very young, you see. So I can't force her.
Very true.
So I encourage her that at least you pray in one rakat namaz, or you need a sajda. Oh, today why didn't you pray? That's it.
Yeah.
So never overdo it. Especially at that young age. And when they grow up to think and understand, that even is the time that you should not overdo it. Like whatever the compulsory set of prayers, let them perform it. But not that, now this is mustahab, but you want this, but you want Allah to listen to your prayers.
Yeah.
You can do it on behalf of them for the time being.
Okay.
And when they see that how you are role playing, then they will do it automatically.
So about praising the child, do you feel there is something like over-praising? For example, is it that we should always praise our children when they're doing good, or should there like be a...
Yes, there should be a limit.
Okay.
In fact, praise for the need performed, not themselves.
Okay.
That's very important. And this is a whole topic altogether. So inshallah, in our future discussions, we will bring that to
inshallah,
the encouragement and praise factor, inshallah. So just now, we just want to briefly outline the don'ts in religious training especially, okay?
Okay, perfect, inshallah. So we'll get back to that after the short break. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We were discussing about the important factors whilst training our children and the don'ts. That's what you were mentioning. So you said that we don't have to do it harshly. We shouldn't force them. We should explain, discuss, and generally be a good role model so that they can just, you know, learn from our actions. And then you said, don't overdo it. We should try and be moderate. We shouldn't force them to do mustahabat because they don't really like the recommended acts. But we can encourage or praise to a certain extent.
Yeah. And another don't overdo it point would be that you also should not overdo it if they wouldn't like that from you.
Okay.
You know, sometimes the parent keeps on and on reciting duas and namaz and things like that, or goes on and on going from one gathering to another to, you know, take part in azadari, and the child is fed up.
Oh, that's very
interesting. Mother is not there with me.
Yeah.
Or the child is fed up that she can't talk to the mother because she's always praying and doing dua. Or she's always in the tasmeen in her
hand. To be balanced.
So balance, yeah, yourself. But if the child doesn't mind, it's another thing. Okay. But some children actually do mind. It's like when you take a mobile and you keep on chatting and the child wants to talk to you, you'll feel like throwing the mobile away, right?
Yeah.
So it's like that. Like, of course, this is talking to Allah. And we all have our pleasurable moments with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through namaz and dua. But if the child does not like it, then don't make him feel that this is what Islam wants from
him. Or don't, because maybe then the child will not like the action then.
Yeah.
And wouldn't like to do it in himself.
Yeah, exactly. He'll feel that this is what Islam calls for.
Yeah.
You know, being so like, oh, you know, just in your own world and just talking to Allah. You can do it in your other private moments also. There are ways also.
Yeah.
It's like a woman who just wants to do her ibadat and she doesn't clean her house.
Mm.
That is not moderate personality, right?
Definitely.
So never overdo it. And then don't teach Islam to show off.
Mm.
This is very important. Children should be taught that to be religious is not that the parents should be proud of you. They should have the satisfaction themselves. This is very important.
You can you elaborate?
Yeah, I can elaborate this way that, you know, this feeling that when you go there, I want people to say that, look, so-and-so's daughter or son is, mashallah, so, you know, good hijab.
Yeah, so Islamic, mashallah.
So Islamic, so well-mannered. No, this is for your own betterment.
Yeah.
Teach that, inculcate that in them. And of course, parents can do that by encouraging also the child at home and not praising them outside too much, like near people, that my daughter did this, or she's finished, for example, reading a Quran in the month of Ramadan. She did this, so that the child can keep on. Now then the child will depend on people's praises and they'll feel that this is the only good outcome that comes, you know, and they won't get that. There won't be time for getting that own satisfaction through doing that action. So that's very important to teach them that how do you feel when you do that. That's very important,
because then they'll feel like, okay, whenever they do an action, they'll be waiting for the praise. If the praise doesn't come, they don't do
that
action.
Exactly. Then they'll feel that today no praise came, so I didn't do it properly, so I leave now doing this thing. It's no use because maybe it wasn't good enough. So it should be done in such a way that the parents should feel that you, your Lord is pleased with you. You know, it takes away so many other diseases of the heart also, that I-ness in you, that boastfulness, you know, that bragging nature, that I'm doing this, I'm doing that, that wanting to keep your own good deed as a secret in future, which is a very good thing, that you never let out your good deeds to people. And you don't, you know, even if you recited, for example, the Tahajjud prayers, you shouldn't, you know, you should keep it a secret, right?
Because you did it for Allah. You wanted
exactly
to be...
Allah will give you the reward of it, and Allah is, you know, more powerful than and more richer than everybody.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah, you can't even compare that. So anyway,
that's very interesting, inshallah. So we're just going to stop for a short break and we'll continue with this discussion. Please stay tuned.
The Prophet ﷺ said,
A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. We were discussing on how we want to train our children to be raised Islamically, and we should be aware of what not to do.
Right.
So we mentioned some of the don'ts, and you mentioned that we shouldn't overdo, for example, the things that the child doesn't want us to do, even if they're good things. For example, recommended acts. If we overdo it, then the child will feel like she's not giving enough time for me, and, you know, I don't like that act. And also, we don't want to teach Islam in a way that it's for show off. So the child shouldn't feel like doing things just so that other people can praise and that, you know, oh, people should know that they're such a good person. But it should be inculcated that it's for the child's own betterment, and he's doing it for Allah, and slowly, slowly that would become, you know, inculcated.
And last but not least, don't make Islam a burden in general. Some parents, you know, they portray Islam in such a way that it's very difficult. For example, they don't prepare the children for first, and then when the time comes, they say, oh, now you have to do it. If you don't do it, you know, this will happen. So it becomes a burden. So inculcate them from a young age to have this happiness in doing it. So
it will come naturally.
Yeah, it shouldn't become a burden. So, you know, even when you feel that it's a burden on them, for example, certain rules like performing of hijab and fasting and such rules, that you pass that energy to them. They will also feel, yeah, it's a very big burden. I can't, for example, fast for 16 hours. Even the long days, they are proven. Near my eyes, I know of children who have fasted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 16 hours is not a big thing. But when parents give them this feeling of Islam being a burden, then that feeling will, of course, naturally come within a child, that Islam is a burden.
Yeah.
So never feel that Islam is a burden. Don't make Islam a burden for them. Make it very light-hearted, very enjoyable for them.
Very
easily reachable and very much within our capacity.
Yeah.
Okay? So that the child can be encouraged. And that's why certain principles have to be shown and taught from a very young age, the way I mentioned, like hijab and prayers, for example, salat, and with joy, so that they cannot forget the feeling it first brought about to them. That's very important. Mm. You know, first of all, what feeling did this bring about to you?
Yeah.
For example, praying, you know, like after that, the parents take her to the park or the shop to buy some toy. So she'll always think, or he'll always think, that going to the mosque, after that we have a ride, a small ride, or to the park or to the shop, or, you know, to buy something. And we have an outlet for ourselves,
yeah,
right?
Making them look forward to it.
Yeah, I would like to share some wise words here.
Okay.
That a virtuous child, because we want to raise our child Islamically and we want to follow these things, that we should not do the don'ts. We should do the do's and leave the don'ts. So that makes a virtuous child come into being. It's like a fragrant flower. And these are from the flowers of heaven. And this is taught by our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
That's very beautiful, mashallah. The hadith is very beautiful. I think generally we just have to be careful on what we should not do, because if we do them, then our children are not benefiting, and they're just going to not look at Islam the way it is. Islam is so beautiful, but I feel like because of our lack of knowledge, we made it very limited. Well, Islam is so wide and it inculcates everything. We just have
to. It's a complete way of life.
Yeah,
right?
We just have to enhance that, you know, this
outlook
yeah. exactly for the children, and slowly, slowly, as you said, from a young age, then inshallah they will grow up and they will, you know, realize
become that
this
virtuous child, like a, you know, fragrant flower, and spread the smell, you know, in every part of the.
Yeah, very true. Inshallah. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us today, Sister Salma. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irrb.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life.
a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
As Americans grapple with how or whether to gather with loved ones this holiday season, the roughly 2 million people confined in the nation's prisons and jails face an even grimmer challenge: how to stay alive inside a system being ravaged by the coronavirus pandemic. What you just heard was from an article authored by the editorial board of the New York Times under the heading, "America is Letting the Coronavirus Rage Through Prisons." Please stay with us for more of the New York Times article. It's both a moral failure and a public health one. Like the nation overall, United States correctional facilities are experiencing record spikes in coronavirus infections this fall. During the week of 17th of November, there were 13,657 new coronavirus infections reported across the state and federal prison systems, according to the Marshall Project, which has been tracking these numbers since March. The previous week saw 13,676 new cases. These are by far the highest weekly tolls reported since the pandemic began. With winter descending, the situation threatens to grow bleaker still. The American penal system is a perfect breeding ground for the virus. Squabbles over face masks and wearing masks and social distancing are essentially moot inside overcrowded facilities, many of them old and poorly ventilated, with tight quarters and with hygiene standards that are difficult to maintain. Uneven testing, inadequate medical resources, and constant churn off of staff members, visitors, and inmates further speed the transmission of the virus. Cruder still, inmates suffer disproportionately from comorbidities, such as high-level, high blood pressure and asthma, putting them at an elevated risk for complications and death. 8 months into the pandemic, the precise shape and scope of the devastation remains difficult to pin down, but the available data is heartbreaking. As of mid-November, more than 196,600 coronavirus infections had been reported among state and federal prisons in the United States. More than 1,450 of those prisoners had died. The case rates among inmates are more than four times as high as those of the general public, and the death rate is more than twice as high. Inmates are not the only ones trapped with the virus. The correctional system employs more than 685,000 people. These are prison guards, nurses, and so on. There have been more than 45,470 reported coronavirus infections and 98 deaths among staff members to date. Their case rates are three times as high as for the general public. Of course, these are the reported cases. The real numbers are assumed to be higher. The coronavirus ripples outward from these hotspots, engulfing the families and communities of inmates and workers. The coronavirus does not respect prison walls any more than it respects state or national borders. It will not be confined. This spread poses a particular problem for rural communities. 40% of prisons are in counties with fewer than 50,000 residents, which typically lack the healthcare infrastructure to deal with such outbreaks. Even a modest outbreak can quickly overwhelm local hospitals with scant numbers of ventilators and intensive care unit beds. Local jails face additional challenges. Whilst prisons report much larger case numbers, the rapid turnover in jails, where many people are confined for only a few days or even few hours, enable the virus to circulate swiftly between inmates and the larger community, and makes tracking all that much more difficult. In a report last month on outbreaks in the Mountain West, the New York Times noted that in Cascade County, infections at the local jail made up about a quarter of all known cases in the county. Over 2 months, the facility knowingly released 29 people who were considered actively infected. As with so much about the pandemic, this is a problem that should have been dealt with more aggressively early on. There was a call for reducing overcrowding through early release and other decarceration measures. While some progress has been made, it has been uneven and inadequate. Prisons and jails experience declines in total population, approximately 11% of the incarcerated population in the first half of 2020, according to a report on decarceration put out by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. The report notes that these reductions appear to be mainly the result of declines in arrests, jail bookings and prison admissions related to lockdowns and the closure of state and local courts. It continues, the releases among sentenced jail and prison populations that have occurred have, for the most part, occurred on a case-by-case basis and have been procedurally slow and not well-suited to crisis situations. While many jails saw a population drop during the first few months of the pandemic, the numbers of people being held in jails began climbing again over the summer, according to a September briefing by the Prison Policy Initiative, which analyzed 4,451 county jails. In 88 counties, jail populations are higher now than they were before the pandemic, the briefing notes. Some states have taken legislative action to speed the decarceration process. A bill signed by New Jersey's governor last month permits prisoners with less than a year left on their sentences to be released up to 8 months early. This has already prompted the release of more than 2,000 people, with another 1,000 or more releases anticipated. All too often, though, continued foot dragging or dysfunction by prison officials requires the courts to step in. In the spring and summer, the San Quentin State Prison in California had a major coronavirus outbreak. Built in the mid-1800s and early 1900s, the outdated facility suffered from overcrowding, inadequate medical staffing, exceedingly poor ventilation, extraordinarily close living quarters, and inadequate sanitation, according to a panel of medical experts from the University of California at Berkeley, who were brought in to assess the situation at the prison in June. But By late July, the number of active cases had topped 1,600. Tents were erected to house the sick. Before the outbreak faded, around 2,200 inmates had confirmed coronavirus infections, and 28 inmates had died. In addition, 298 staff members were infected with the virus, resulting in one death. The problem continued to fester. In late October, a state appeals court ruled that the prison authorities' efforts to address the issue had been insufficient, and that inmates' constitutional protection from cruel and unusual punishment was still being violated. To deal with the emergency, the prison was ordered to cut its population by around one half through a mix of releases and transfers. It should be noted that the original outbreak was sparked by the transfer to St. Quentin Correctional Facility of infected inmates from another prison. Clearly, more needs to be done. The report by the National Academies outlines best practices for reducing the incarcerated population, broken down into short-term and long-term solutions. The suggested measures start with a systemic commitment to diversion efforts such as non-custodial penalties for minor infractions, including probation and parole violations, and the limiting of pre-trial detentions through means such as reducing or eliminating bail. In addition to offering guidance on a bolder decarceration effort, the report stresses the importance of minimizing risk to the families and communities involved, such as offering testing prior to release, a place to quarantine in the community, and examination of parole and probation policies and procedures. More comprehensive and more standardized testing and reporting requirements are also needed. Managing this kind of crisis is not a one-and-done effort, the report emphasizes. It is a process requiring sustained engagement with a wide array of actors at all levels. It is all too easy for many Americans to ignore the horrors of what is happening inside the nation's prisons and jails. Inmates are isolated from the broader population, their suffering kept out of sight. But their welfare in this pandemic remains inextricably linked to everyone else's. The nation's continued failure to bring the coronavirus to heel among this vulnerable population is both a public health catastrophe and a moral one as well.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.